This is day two at the 49th New Zealand Christadelphian Bible School. Our third period speaker is Brother Mark Vincent on A Tale Told Twice. This is the second talk in the series. The subtitle for today is Discreet and Wise, and the introductory reading is Genesis chapter 39. Brother Mark.
Good evening.
Good evening.
So let's just have a quick recap of what we talked about yesterday. We left things in a bad way, really, didn't we? Because we talked about how the whole family was going down. Joseph was brought down to the land of Egypt. Jacob was going down mourning to the grave with his grey hairs. And Judah was going down in chapter 38. And the brothers, of course, have sunk to their lowest ebb, haven't they, with their own behavior and the way in which they've treated their brother. But there is hope, because we saw also that there were these parallels, these fascinating parallels and contrasts between the beginning of Joseph's life and the end of Joseph's life, the 17 years at the beginning and the 17 years at the end. So we know, even though Joseph and the brothers and the father don't yet know, that this is all going to end up in a very different place, and we had a quick look at that, didn't we, of how ultimately they were all going to come up again out of the land of Egypt, that God would bring them through this furnace, this trial, and would deliver them and would give to them the hope of the promised land. And so as we pick things up now in chapter 39, we find Joseph arriving in the land of Egypt, and he's brought there by Potiphar, an officer of Pharaoh, captain of the guard, an Egyptian who bought him. So we've got a little series of descriptions, haven't we, of Potiphar there in chapter 39 and verse 1. And we don't quite know, or there's some debate about what exactly his role was. Some people think this term captain of the guard means that he was the chief executioner, which is a bit of a scary thought, isn't it? Who would want to work for him or get on the wrong side of him? Another thought is that he was a cook of some kind, that he was the chief cook. Well, I can't resolve that one. Those are two of the possibilities that are out there. Anyway, he was an important official of some kind. And as we look through those little descriptions of him, there's just this huge contrast. You couldn't think, really, of two more different people than Joseph and Potiphar. They're a bizarre combination, aren't they? And yet, together, they make a great partnership. So, Joseph is a Hebrew slave, and Potiphar is an Egyptian master. And you can see these other points of contrast, which I can't see without peering at my screen here. But obviously you can read those. He is a slave who belongs to traders, and he gets bought from the traders. Potiphar is an officer of Pharaoh. Joseph had been a keeper of sheep. Potiphar is the captain of the guard. Joseph had been the favorite of his father. Potiphar was a man of discipline, perhaps, depending exactly on what this phrase captain of the guard means. I mean, even if he was a cook, you would have to be a pretty disciplined sort of cook, wouldn't you, to be the cook for Pharaoh. And, you know, just the difference in their lifestyles and background. Joseph used to the hills and valleys and rocky crags of Israel, and Potiphar, presumably a man of the city, of sophistication, of culture. The youth and naivety of Joseph, perhaps, contrasted with the experience of Potiphar. Presumably, he's an older man to have risen to this position of authority, because that's the usual way. Joseph, of course, would become an exception to that, wouldn't he? But this was the usual way of things. And yet, despite all these contrasts between these two men, they made, as we say, a great partnership. And it's interesting how Potiphar actually responds to Joseph's faith, doesn't he? We'll have a look at that in more detail in a moment. And it's interesting, isn't it, how the truth similarly brings together people from, you know, we wouldn't be together, would we, as a group, under the normal way of things. I mean, there are people from all kinds of different backgrounds here, aren't there? People of different socioeconomic status, different educational backgrounds, different geographic backgrounds, different ethnicities, perhaps. And what binds us together, of course, is the things of the faith that we share. And God can bring people together from different backgrounds to bring about his purpose. Well, let's take a closer look at what happens between Joseph and Potiphar. Well, that's recorded in verse 2 onwards. And the Lord was with Joseph. Now, that's a great start, isn't it? Doesn't get much better than that as something that might be said about you and as something that one might want to pray for about oneself, that the Lord would be with us. And of course, that very language of the Lord being with us, that's the language of the covenant name, isn't it? Certainly I will be with thee, God had said to Moses in Exodus 3, verses 12 and 14, when he reveals the name Yahweh, the covenant name, to his people. And here it is now, in this account, not the actual, you know, not those actual four letters, but what's encapsulated in them, or one of the aspects of what's encapsulated in them, in this statement that the Lord was with Joseph. And he was a prosperous man. Now, that's a remarkable thing to say, isn't it? Because he was a slave. And slaves aren't normally prosperous men, are they? Now, of course, it could just mean that he was successful, isn't it? And that's, of course, what the translation read that Brother Morrie read from. So that's a possible translation. But it's equally possible to translate it in this way, as prosperous. And, of course, you can be prosperous in different ways, can't you? You can be a man of substance, of different kinds of substances. And you know, we usually... of course, well, I think the word substance is used in a different way again, isn't it now? But you know, a man of substance. We often think about wealth and prosperity in those terms, don't we? A man who has a lot of things, a man who lives in a big house and drives a flash car and has a large balance in his bank. There's that kind of prosperity, but there are other kinds, deeper kinds, more important kinds of wealth and success and riches. So there's an ambiguity about what exactly is meant by that little phrase there. But he was undoubtedly successful, wasn't he? And Potiphar quickly saw that there was something different about Joseph, something that set him apart. And in fact, there were two things that set him apart, weren't there? Because there was another partnership at work here. We've talked about Joseph and Potiphar as a partnership. But the more important partnership is the partnership between Joseph and his God, isn't it? The two things that were important about Joseph were, one, that the Lord was with him, and two, that he was a diligent servant and steward. And again, you take one or the other of those away, and it doesn't work. Does it? It has to be this bringing together of God's blessing, of God's action, and our response, and our action, of our willingness to serve, of our sense of responsibility, of stewardship over the things that God has given us. And Joseph was in the house of his master, the Egyptian, and his master saw that the Lord was with him. So that's interesting then, because that is now telling us that the relationship with Joseph, between Joseph and God, was not a private matter then, was it? It spilled over somehow, and You know, although I don't imagine that Joseph was handing Potiphar pamphlets every day, yet somehow Potiphar knew about Joseph's faith. Potiphar saw that the Lord was with him. It wasn't even just that Joseph said so, whether or not he did. It was that there was something about the way Joseph was and the things that happened when Joseph was around that Potiphar could tell the difference, that he'd never had a slave like this before then. His faith marked him out, and the presence of God in his life marked him out. And this again then provides us an exhortation in our stewardship. His master saw that the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So Potiphar was able to look through Joseph, wasn't he, and to see the Lord beyond. So to the extent that we manage to be diligent in our jobs and in our responsibilities that we must discharge, there's that interesting question or challenge as to whether those we work for, I mean, they may just be not, you know, Potiphar was obviously an observant sort of chap, and the person we work for may or may not be like that, but this possibility that they might be able to see through us to the Lord that we serve, that they might wonder what it is, you know, that we are different in some way and might wonder what it is about us. And Joseph found grace in his sight, and he served him, and he made him overseer over his house, and all that he had he put into his hand. So what we've got here is a situation rather like what we have in the life of Jesus, that he grew in grace and in favor with God and man. So these two things are not mutually exclusive, are they? Sometimes they are. Sometimes our relationship with God brings us into conflict with man and might lead to us being despised and rejected by men. There are times when that happens. But there's also the possibility on other occasions, perhaps when the stakes are lower, as they are here, that that this can work out. And that, as it was for Jesus. So what appears from that then is that Jesus, and therefore Joseph, they were not misfits, were they? They weren't odd for the sake of being odd. Do you know what I mean? They were well-adjusted people in some way as far as society went, and they were thus able to find favor with man, even though the favor of God was more important to them. So Jesus must have been a diligent carpenter in training, mustn't he? And he must have treated people with respect and been liked and likable in the way that he conducted himself. And you get the same picture at the start of David's life, don't you? You know, the relationship between David and God is very clear, but it's also clear when David makes his way from Bethlehem and into the court that the whole way David conducted himself was one that brought the admiration and the respect of his fellow men. So it's encouraging to us that is a possibility, that is something for us to aim for and strive for. Now, of course, when there is a choice between, you know, is it God or man, then, of course, we know which is the most important, don't we? But it is possible in some circumstances in life to hold both of these things together. Now, what we've got going on in these verses about Joseph and Potiphar between verse 1 and verse 6 is a whole lot of repetition. And again, the scriptures are highlighting to us what they want us to notice. That little word, all. It's used again and again and again. And the idea of the things in Joseph's hand and the idea of Potiphar delegating responsibility to Joseph, of making Joseph a steward by putting things into his hand, is repeated again and again. The Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand, and all that he had he put into his hand. He made him overseer in his house and over all that he had. The blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had, and he left all that he had in Joseph's hand. And Joseph himself says, my master has committed all that he hath to my hand. Again, it's pretty insistent repetition, isn't it? And all of it emphasizing Joseph's diligence as a steward. Now, we are all stewards. And the Lord Jesus Christ told parables about stewards and what sort of steward we should be. We're stewards not just of the physical assets we possess. We're also stewards of our reputation, of the influence that we can have on other people. We're stewards of our children, some of the most precious assets that we have. We're stewards of the faith that's been entrusted to us. We're stewards of the talents and the abilities that we possess, and of the responsibilities that we carry. We're stewards of all these things and others besides. And Joseph is a wonderful example of excellence in stewardship in every area of his life, in all these things, whatever it was that Potiphar put into his hand, all of it, every last bit, Joseph was faithful. Now, if we then move to the end of the chapter, verse 21 to 23, what do we find? So Joseph has now been put into prison by Potiphar, and here he is in the prison house, but we find the very same thing, don't we? The keeper of the prison committed to Joseph's hand all the prisoners that were in the prison, and whatsoever, or all, or everything that they did there, he was the doer of it. The keeper of the prison looked not to anything that was under his hand. It's exactly the same, isn't it? Joseph's ability in stewardship is irrepressible. Whatever circumstance he finds himself in, whether he is in the house of Potiphar, whether he is in the house of the prison, or whether he is in the house of Pharaoh, he cannot but be a steward of the first order. And automatically, people just start giving him stuff, don't they? People just start giving him responsibility, things for him to look after, because they know he'll take care of it. He'll delegate his he'll discharge his responsibilities in an appropriate way, and that the Lord is with him. Absolutely wonderful. And, of course, that's our calling, isn't it? That we should serve our earthly masters when there is no conflict with the commands of our Lord, that we should serve as unto the Lord, and that we should have that same diligence that Joseph had. And again, here in the prison house, even in prison, he finds favor with God and with man. Now, we jumped a little bit. Let's just come back into Potiphar for a second. We got about into verse around about verse 5. Why don't we have a look at verse 5? And it came to pass from the time that he had made him overseer in his house and over all that he had, that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had in the house and in the field. Now this is a partial fulfillment of the promises to Abraham, isn't it? Because what God had said to Abraham was that his seed would be a blessing, and that Abraham would be a blessing. And here is Abraham's, what is it, great-grandson now, being a blessing in the house of Potiphar, and being a blessing in the prison house, and ultimately being a blessing in the house of Pharaoh, and being, in fact, the savior of the world. So, a delightful little pickup there of the language of Genesis when it says that the Lord blessed the Egyptian's house for Joseph's sake, and the blessing of the Lord was upon all that he had. And he knew not all that aught that he had, save the bread which he did eat. And Joseph was a goodly person and well favored. So let's step back again and just look at the chapter as a whole. And what have we got in the chapter? We've got Joseph as a steward in Potiphar's house. And then we've got the incident with Joseph and Potiphar's wife. And then we've got Joseph as a steward in the prison, haven't we? So we've got a structure here. We've got a shape, haven't we? We've got a pattern. And just to emphasize those connections between the beginning and the end, between Joseph with Potiphar and Joseph in the prison, there's this delegation of authority, isn't there, from the one in charge, from Potiphar or from the prison keeper to Joseph. There's the finding favor that Joseph finds favor in their sight. Everything, all is put into his hand, and nothing is excluded. There's quite a laborious expression is used in both accounts. Whatsoever there was there that was done there, he was the doer of it, it says, doesn't it? And something similar in relation to Potiphar. The sight of Potiphar and the sight of the prison keeper is mentioned. And most strikingly of all, how many times does it say that the Lord was with Joseph in the Potiphar account? It says it twice. It says, and the Lord was with Joseph, and he became a prosperous man. And Potiphar saw that the Lord was with Joseph two times. How many times does it say that the Lord was with Joseph in the account of Joseph with the prison keeper? Exactly the same. The Lord was with Joseph, and the Lord was with Joseph. And this is just, this series is called A Tale Told Twice, and we won't really get into that until tomorrow's session, but here's just the start of it. That this crucial fact about Joseph should be told us twice in these two accounts. We're told twice, not just once, but twice. You see that? At the beginning and then at the end of the chapter. So that we cannot miss the consistency of Joseph's stewardship in all circumstances, even when you're in prison, when you're a slave, when you're working for Potiphar, or whether you're in prison. You might think, well, all my freedom is taken away from me. What have I got left now to be a steward of? Well, Joseph points the way there, that we are always a steward of ourselves and of our conduct and of our responses and of how we'll react in situations that come into our lives. And Joseph is consistent, and God is consistent in his blessing of Joseph in these different situations. Now, again, it's just useful to think about the flip side, isn't it? Do you know people who are inconsistent? Do you know people, perhaps, who are moody? Perhaps people who you work with, and one day they'll be all smiles and cheery, and the next day you'll walk right past them in the corridor and they won't even look at you. And of course, it can be a medical condition, can't it, of bipolar or a manic depressive condition where people have these two different things going on, and of course there's a medical aspect to it there. But if we just think about that as a metaphor for a second, that's not what we see in Joseph, is it? We see this consistency in all these horrible circumstances that he found himself in. His spirit of service was not stinted. It was not repressed. It shone through, and his character brought him back up again. It was spotted, wasn't it? And he started to prosper again because the Lord was with him. His behavior is patterned and consistent. Now, who else do we know who's like that? Well, of course, our God is like that. We were talking about this morning. From everlasting to everlasting, he is God. And the very consistency that he has, he looks for in his servants too. Well, that's the first half, more than half probably, of the talk and of our studies of this chapter, looking at those examples of Joseph as a steward, the lesson of good stewardship, service unto the Lord in all circumstances that we find ourselves. What then of the episode in the middle of Joseph and Potiphar's wife? Let's take a closer look at that. And it came to pass after these things, verse 7, that his master's wife cast her eyes upon Joseph, and she said, "Lie with me." Now, there's something very abrupt about that, isn't there? There's something raw about it. There's something in your face about it. And to me, it's a very contemporary thing, that very openness, the bluntness of it, because that's how our world is now about these physical things, isn't it? We were talking about it with the teens, about how the society that we live in has come to worship sex as a god. And, you know, there's nothing off limits as far as, you know, almost as far as society is concerned. And it is in our faces. The world just puts it there all the time and contempt us with its way of thinking that we should start to think in those ways too. And here then is this blatant temptation right in front of Joseph. And so direct, three words in English. You know, there's no foreplay here from her, is there? She gets right to the point there, "Lie with me." Three words in English, two words in Hebrew. It's even more brief. She knows what she wants, and she's determined that she's going to get it. And what about Joseph? Well, Joseph is rather more long-winded. If you look at his answer to what she says, that begins in verse 8 and goes on into verse 9. And verse 9 is quite a long verse, you'll notice. So he speaks 60 words in English, 35 words in Hebrew, in response to that. So there's this, you know, there's this short and direct command from her with this long and perhaps somewhat rambling explanation from Joseph as to that's part of his refusal. Well, of course, it's not rambling. He's making a point, but you can imagine his very shock and awkwardness in dealing with this situation perhaps causes him to be, you know, when people don't quite know what to say, they sometimes say more than might strictly be necessary, don't they? And Joseph does have a point, though, of course. And let's have a look at his words. "Behold, my master wotteth not what is with me in the house, and he hath committed all that he hath to my hand. There is none greater in his house than I, neither hath he kept back anything from me but thee, because thou art his wife." So you see what he does? He uses his position of responsibility as a basis for being responsible, doesn't he? What's the sinful tendency in that situation? It's to use your position of responsibility as an opportunity to take advantage, isn't it? That's the flip side. That's the alternative to what Joseph does here. It's to say, "Oh yes, I do have a good opportunity here, don't I? Well, I should take it then." And, you know, to start to reason with himself, "Look, I've done all this work for Potiphar, you know, slaving every day, and I do such a good job looking after all this stuff, but and he doesn't spare a thought for what my physical needs might be and whether, you know, I might like to have a family of my own and what sort of relationship I might..." You know, he might well have started reasoning in that kind of way, might, you know, the sort of poor me sort of way in which that we can justify to our, you know, we start to talk like this to ourselves, our inner voice in order to justify and legitimize sins sometimes. But Joseph's approach is the very opposite, to say, look what a position of responsibility I've been called to. And what am I going to do? Am I going to just throw that all away for some cheap thrills? The responsibility is the basis for doing the best for the highest standard. And of course, the other striking thing about what he says, as you well know, is that he should say, Potiphar hasn't kept back anything from me but you, because you are his wife. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against Potiphar? Because he's just been talking about Potiphar, hasn't he? About how Potiphar has put all these things but kept back his wife. So how could I sin against my master? And of course, you know that isn't what he says, is it? It would be true. It would be perfectly true, and that would be perfectly good enough reason not to do this sin. And it would be perfectly good reason to say, how can I sin against myself? Or how can I sin against you? Because it would have been a sin against all of those parties, wouldn't it? But he sees an even higher basis for his behavior. How then can I do this great wickedness and sin against God? And it came to pass as she spoke to Joseph day by day. And think about the temptation of that. I thought about this in two ways. You know, but perhaps the acutest temptation would have been the first time it happened. And that then, you know, subsequently it's like, well, I've faced that situation before. I know what to do. Well, maybe. But then again, you have different feelings on different days, don't you? Sometimes something can be a temptation one day, another day it's not a temptation at all, and then another day it's a massive temptation. And this temptation just came at him and at him and at him. And so what did he do? He came up with a plan then to avoid the temptation, because he understood what he was made of, and he understood how strong the temptation could be. And therefore it says, he hearkened not unto her to lie by her or to be with her. So he took himself out as far as possible from the situation which would have caused a temptation to him. I mean, it would have been very flattering. I mean, we don't know whether she was an attractive woman or not, but, you know, probably any woman offering herself in this way would be attractive or would certainly be flattering to a man. It flatters your ego, doesn't it? How could it not do? And so even if you were not going to actually take the action any further, you might just like to have your ego stroked by just being reminded about it. And there can be that within us, can't there, of wanting to sort of play brinkmanship, you know, to not do the thing, whatever it is, but to get as close as possible, to just indulge in the feelings a little bit, to flirt with the temptation, to enjoy the flattery. And, you know, this is, of course, an exhortation about the dangers of sexual sin and of taking it very seriously and of taking whatever precautions we need to take to not put ourselves in a situation where it's a threat to us, where it's a danger to us, to realize that we're not as strong as we think we are, and that we can be weak and fall, but that we have responsibilities to God, so we must take the steps necessary not to put ourselves into those situations, to avoid them as far as possible. So the idea of, you know, just of harmless flirting because it's fun, it just doesn't work, does it? It just doesn't fit in. It can have no place. It might make us feel good for a moment, do we realize what we're playing with? Do we realize the potential harm that can come from that if that's what we do? Joseph understood the importance of this, and he took himself out of the situation. But of course, you know, this isn't just about sexual sin, is it? Because sexual sin, of course, in the scriptures, is also used as a metaphor for talking about all sin. The, you know, the strong male temptation that presents is, you know, when Proverbs talks about it, you know, Proverbs 7 and passages like that, you know, the woman, the temptress woman, It's not just about physical temptation of that kind, is it? It's about the temptation of all sin, about how all sin is attractive to us, and you know, we're desirous of it from time to time, at the wrong moment, with the wrong set of stimuli. Whether we're male or female, that will come upon us, and we need to be as preemptive and as ready to defend as Joseph is here in those circumstances. But of course, he couldn't take himself out of the situation completely, and there was this time when Joseph had to go into the house to do his business, and there was no one else in the house, and she caught him by his garment, saying, "Lie with me again." And he left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. Now, this thing about the garment is very interesting, because we've already read about a garment of Joseph, haven't we? And we already saw what happened to it. Someone took his garment off, didn't they? His brothers took his garment off and dipped it in the kid of the goats. And now this woman grabs hold of his garment, and Joseph flees away and leaves his garment behind. And in both cases, the garment is used as an instrument of deception, isn't it? The garment dipped in blood, which deceives Jacob into thinking that a wild beast has devoured him. And the garment here, left by her side and carefully put there on his Potiphar's side of the bed, so that Potiphar would be fooled into thinking that it really had happened as she put it. But those aren't the only references to garments. If you just turn over the page for a second into chapter 41 now. And Joseph, and Pharaoh, of course, has dreamed his dreams, and Joseph is called out of the prison to interpret them. And in that chapter 41 and verse 14, "Then Pharaoh sent and called Joseph, and they brought him hastily out of the dungeon. And he shaved himself and changed his raiment and came in unto Pharaoh." And then, of course, he interpreted Pharaoh's dreams. And then after he'd done that and Pharaoh promoted him, verse 42, "And Pharaoh took off his ring from his hand and put it on Joseph's hand and arrayed him in vestures of fine linen and put a gold chain about his neck." So throughout the life of Joseph then, there is this series of changing of clothes, isn't there? So first of all, his father, I mean, presumably Joseph is wearing something, and Joseph puts on him, Jacob puts on him the coat of many colors. And then his brothers take the coat off, and then presumably some slave's clothes are wrapped around him. And then perhaps he gets some new garments in Potiphar's house, who knows, that's not stated. And then there's the incident with Potiphar's wife, who steals whatever it is, Joseph's garment that he's wearing. Then he goes into prison, so presumably he puts prison garments on at that point. And then when he goes to meet Pharaoh, he takes the prison garments off and changes his raiment. And then when Pharaoh exalts him, he puts these robes on him, and at last he's wearing the right clothes for the job that he ends up doing. What's it all about, all this changing of clothes? Well, in a way, this changing of your clothes, it's like scene markers, isn't it? You know, it's like the curtain falling and rising in a play from Act 1, Scene 1, to Act 1, Scene 2, and so it goes on. And the clothes are a metaphor for the changing circumstances of Joseph's life. And, you know, it'd be tough to think of anyone who had such radically shifting changes of circumstances as Joseph, wouldn't it? And for each of those circumstances he's in, he gets a new set of clothes to wear. And then it's, okay, that phase is done now, and we take those clothes off, and we have a wardrobe change, and we put on some other clothes. And then he goes through that phase of life, and then that comes to an end, and we take those off and put some other clothes on. But the point is, what is going on underneath, isn't it? It's not about the outward, is it? It's not about what you wear on the outside. God isn't looking at our clothes in that sense. God cares about what's going on in our hearts. And that brings us back to the consistency of Joseph, doesn't it? The external environment of Joseph was always changing as he went from being with his father to with his brothers to with the Midianites to with Potiphar to with the prison to with Pharaoh. The externals were always changing, but we've seen Joseph's consistency as a steward, that in whatever circumstance he was in, the Lord was with him and that the Lord made all that he did to prosper in his hand. So that's the challenge for us then, isn't it? Because we've all been changing our clothes through our lives, haven't we? And I don't mean what you chose to put on when you got up this morning. I mean, you know, there was a time when you were when you were at school. There was a time when you were at university, perhaps. There was a time before you were married. There was a time before you had children. The time when you have children. The time when the children leave home. The time when you did that job. The time when you did another job. A time when you retired. A time when you lived here. A time when you lived there. Always changing, isn't it? Always changing. But what's going on underneath? What is happening there? In that inner man, what's going on? And it's Joseph's ability to live through all that, isn't it? And to be unchangeable in his stewardship, which is so impressive about him. Well, we sort of jumped out of the narrative of Potiphar's wife there to talk about changes of clothes, but let's jump back into it again, and we were in verse 12, weren't we? And it came to pass, when she saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth, that she called unto the men of her house and spake unto them, saying, and this is brilliant, right? Just her ability here to just orchestrate the situation and achieve what she wants to achieve. You know, there's that phrase, isn't there? Hell hath no fury like a woman scorned. And that's nowhere better seen, I think, than in this scene. Look at what she says to the servants. See, he, Potiphar, hath brought in a Hebrew to mock us. You know, and there's implicit racism in that, isn't there? She knows that the other servants don't like the Hebrews, so she calls him this Hebrew, and she wants to get them on her side. So what does she say? She identifies herself with them, doesn't she? You know, I'm just one of you, really, slaves. You know, I know I'm the woman of the house, but really, I'm just like you. And he, that Potiphar, what a rascal! He brought in this Hebrew slave to mock us. How dare he mock us? Doesn't he know we're all good slaves here? You know, then they shouldn't be mocked, should they? He came in unto me to lie with me, and I cried out with a loud voice. Oh, the pathos of the scene! The poor exploited woman here. And it came to pass when he heard that I lifted up my voice and cried, that he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And then she carefully places the garment by her side until his lord came home. And she spoke unto him according to these words, saying, the Hebrew servant. So now she's the woman of the house again now, isn't she? And the servants are like kind of down there, you know, where we don't actually speak their names, but just the Hebrew servant, which thou hast brought unto us. So it's thou now, isn't it? There's a bit more. But there's also this implicit, you know, you didn't really make a very good choice there, did you? Came in to me to mock me. It's not us now, it's me, isn't it, that's being mocked. And it came to pass, as we've just read, he left his garment with me and fled and got him out. And it came to pass when the master heard the words of his wife, which she spake unto him, saying, after this manner did thy servant to me, that his wrath was kindled. Now, there's an interesting ambiguity here, because it doesn't say who his wrath was kindled with, does it? And of course, the natural assumption is that it was kindled with Joseph. And as we read on to the next verse, his master took him and put him in the prison, to a place where the king's prisoners. That's what you would expect he would do, and that would seem to support that it is indeed Joseph that Potiphar is angry with. That's probably the most likely reading, but you know, there is just the possibility that perhaps he suspects that this incident might not be all that it appears to be. Perhaps he knows something about his wife, and he certainly knows something about Joseph, or he thought he did, didn't he? And it's been suggested that, you know, he was perfectly within his right to just have Joseph killed on the spot for this. I mean, this was a crime worthy of death, to do such a thing as she'd accused him of. And yet he doesn't do that. He doesn't take the obvious punishment here. I mean, you think he might just grab his sword himself and take Joseph's life. But no, he puts him in the prison. So perhaps he's not sure. Perhaps he even suspects Joseph's innocence. But, you know, for the sake of whatever social customs and the seriousness of the accusation, perhaps he has to take this course of action. We can't say. There is another possibility, and again, this is hearsay from another brother, and Brother Andrew Pierce, who'd done some work on this, and he, according to his research, he'd found that it was common in Egyptian households for property rights to pass through the wife, so that the house and the stuff could have been all in her name, and that may have been a reason why he had to pretty much jump when she said and do as she'd insinuated. Now, who knows whether any of those or which of those is right? But you know, it's just interesting to wonder about, at least, isn't it? What is certain, though, is that in this little account of Joseph and Potiphar's wife, there is some more repetition. Did anyone spot what it was? It's in verse 12. It's in verse 13. It's in verse 15. It's in verse 18. It's this. Emergency evacuation, I've called it. He left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out. She saw that he had left his garment in her hand and was fled forth. She said, "He left his garment with me and fled and got him out." She said, "He left his garment with me and fled out." So, four times, isn't it? Four times the scriptures are reminding us from the mouths of different people, admittedly, but reminding us that Joseph didn't miss a beat, did he? When this temptation presented itself, he was gone. He was out of there. You couldn't see him. You know, all that was left was the dust of him getting out of that situation as quick as possible. That's a tough act, isn't it, to follow with whatever temptation we're faced with, but it's a great example. And it arises from an appreciation of, it arises from an abhorrence of sin, doesn't it, really? An appreciation of how hurtful and how sin is to God and how upsetting it is for him and how antithetical it is to him, and how it angers him also. And it does all those things to Joseph too, because he's come to be like the God that he worships. And that's why he leaves his garment in her hand, never minding what the consequences are, and flees and gets him out. And it says it four times, doesn't it? And we've already met something else that is said four times in the chapter. Twice at the beginning it said, "And the Lord was with him," "And the Lord was with him." And now four times in the center it says, "He left his garment in her hand and fled and got him out." And then twice at the end it says, "The Lord was with him, the Lord was with him." And I wonder if those things are connected. And I think that they illustrate two crucial aspects of discipleship. And really, these three episodes that we've considered this evening illustrate two crucial aspects of discipleship. There is, first of all, what you do. And in the scene with Joseph in Potiphar's house, and in the scene with Joseph in the prison house, at the beginning and at the end of the chapter, when the Lord is with Joseph, we've seen positively what Joseph does. We've seen the excellent, first-class execution of his responsibilities as steward. We've seen him busying himself, going about doing the things that he's supposed to be doing, looking after his master's goods, discharging his responsibilities. Those are the things that you do. The Lord God has asked us to do things, to go out there and labor in his vineyard, to spread the good news so that others might see that the Lord is with us, to be good stewards over the assets that God has put in our charge. But that's only one aspect of discipleship. The other aspect of discipleship is the things that you don't do, the things that displease God and sadden him. And Joseph is an excellent example of that as well. And that's what we see in this middle episode of Joseph and Potiphar's wife and in the fourfold repetition of his emergency evacuation. And that's what we need to try to inculcate in our own discipleship, isn't it? This sense of responsibility that ultimately it's not man or our boss or whoever who puts responsibilities into our hand. It's God who is the great orchestrator of everything, and it's before him that we must discharge our responsibilities. And there are things that he has asked us not to do and which he's told us are displeasing to him. And the more we can be like Joseph and just run away from those things, the more we'll please our Heavenly Father. And then on the other side is those wonderful positive things that God has asked us to do consistently in whatever circumstance we find ourselves in, just like Joseph.